This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Alan Cameron. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Cameron is in Waihee, New Zealand. It is the 3rd of November, the year 2000, at approximately 3:15 Lubbock time in the afternoon. Mr. Cameron, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Right. Now, I was born in Hamilton, New Zealand, on the 27th of April, 1945. My parents were my mother is still alive, Sylvia Mary Cameron. My father was Emil Ewan Cameron. He is now deceased. They were both born in New Zealand. My grandparents, on my maternal side, my grandmother was born in Nelson, New Zealand. My grandfather was born in the United Kingdom. On the paternal side, my grandmother was born in New Zealand. My grandfather was also born in New Zealand. I lived basically all of my life from the time I was about 4.5 years old. I lived all my life in a small town in the Bay of Plenty called Edgecombe, where I went to primary school and then travelled 12 miles to Whakatane to attend the local high school. The community I lived in was too small at that particular time to support a high school of its own. I spent 5 years in secondary school. We have a slightly different system in New Zealand to what you have, but I started high school at the age of 12 and finished at about 17. Then I left school and went to work within the local community. So far, so good?
Absolutely. What year was that you graduated?
We don't really graduate from high school ever.
Okay.
Funny says, well, in 1962, when I left school, you just walked out of school and that was it. There was no ceremony, no razzmatazz, nothing. We just left school and went to work.
Okay.
Very few New Zealanders in 1962 actually went any further with their education. In fact, my 5 years at high school would be considered to have been one of the longer periods that people from a community like that would spend at high school. Further education was something that was reserved for those wanting to become doctors and lawyers and engineers and that type of thing. And at that stage in New Zealand, there was so much employment. I think we might have had between 7 and 10 persons unemployed in a country of 3 million people. So nobody really worried about it. You just left school and went to work.
Mm-hmm.
The school leaving age, incidentally, at that time was 15,
mm-hmm.
and there were quite a few people who, attaining the age of 15, regardless of how long they'd been at school, they went to school on on the first day of their 15th year, and that was it. Gone. All over. So I think that explains that. I have one younger brother and one younger sister, so I'm the eldest of three children.
Mm-hmm. Did you have... Oh, I'm sorry.
Carry on, sorry.
I was just going to ask if that carried with it your position within your family as the oldest child, if you had any particular responsibilities in your family in terms of taking care of your brother and
not
sister.
Really. That responsibility has been assumed in later years when the so particularly since my father's death, I would suggest, which was about 3 years ago, when I now become virtually the senior male in the family. The fact that my brother is currently living and working in Kuala Lumpur means that I'm the last. Male bastion left in New Zealand, so we tend to spend a lot of time, well, as much time as we can, with my mother, who still lives in Edgecombe, which is 150 kilometres from where we're living. So we will quite often drive down there for an afternoon, have dinner or supper or whatever you call it with her, and then come back again. That's about as far as the responsibility of being the eldest in the family goes, I think. I tended to get the job of making all the speeches at family functions. 50th wedding anniversary and 50th wedding anniversaries and 80th birthday parties. Everybody sort of handed me the knife to cut the cake with, to make the speech, to give the knife to the appropriate person to do whatever with.
Mm-hmm. What kind of work did you do once you graduated?
When I left school, the first job I had was working in the office of a timber company,
mm-hmm.
which was basically clerical work. And after that, I did that for 12 months. And then I left home and went on what you might call a working holiday within New Zealand. I went to Wellington and I lived and worked down there. I worked at the places like the Ford Motor Company, who were assembling vehicles there. I had a job in the assembly plant and drifted into the... I always had a mechanical bent, so I drifted into garages, became, over a long period of time, became a mechanic and used that as a job everywhere I went. You just wander into a place and, there was always, that's what I said before, there was always plenty of employment. In fact, in some places they was, crying out for somebody to work for them. So, it doesn't matter what you did, as long as you were able-bodied, you could get a job.
Okay. By that time, that's about 1963 that you started traveling and you found yourself into the more urbanized areas of New Zealand.
Yep.
How aware were you of major international events? For instance, in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1963, the assassination of President Ngo Dinh Diem in Vietnam, the Kennedy assassination. Were these things that were covered well in New Zealand?
Yeah, you've got to look at New Zealand's perspective on the rest of the world. Let me put it this way. What happens in New Zealand does not really affect United States politics, Australian politics, Chinese politics, right? It doesn't really have a bearing on what goes on in the rest of the world. The other way around, what happens in the United States of America is very important to us because it affects our economy quite badly. At the moment, we're dying in this country because our dollar is now worth 40 cents US. If I was to come to America for on holiday, for every dollar that I spend US, for every 40 cents I spend US, it's going to cost me a dollar New Zealand. Now, our wages are generally a little bit lower than yours, so you can imagine what that does when you think of a breakfast at $4 is actually going to cost me $10 New Zealand. So that's, those sort of things have a bearing on the way we act and the way we think. We knew about President Kennedy's assassination, of course. That was big news in New Zealand. The Cuban crisis, we watched that with interest. Because these things affect, there's a possibility that we're going to get asked to help in some of these situations. What happens in Australia? The political situation in Australia affects us to a great degree. So we study the rest of the world a lot more closely than the rest of the world studies us, you understand what I mean by that?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay. Like, right now you guys are having a presidential election, and it will be fourth item on the major television news broadcasts in New Zealand. That's how important it is to us.
Okay.
All right, at the moment, the major item on the news in New Zealand is what's happening in Fiji,
mm-hmm.
where they're having a political and military crisis and coup over there, so that's because that's closer to us and there's a lot of New Zealanders there, that affects us. But that's why your elections have been relegated to sort of second or third.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of this, we're at the end of the week, by Monday they will be top line news and your voting. We've got we've actually got television reporters who have gone from New Zealand. There's one in LA at the moment because of the election. That's how important it is to us. Same applies when things like that happen in Australia. We know exactly what's going on.
Well, do you remember anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62?
Not really, but I was young. Yeah, 17 at the time. We knew it was happening because it was in our newspapers, but we weren't, we didn't feel that it was of major importance to us. You've got to remember that since that time, I have read and studied and watched a lot of footage of that sort of stuff on TV, and so some of this is sort of bits and pieces I've picked up since. But we definitely knew it was happening. I think the blockade would have been probably what we were we were more interested in watching.
That's right.
So we knew it was going on. Kennedy's assassination, we knew probably within the time it takes for radio communications or teleprint communications to get here, we knew straight away that he had been assassinated. We knew that straight away.
Do you recall what the tenor of the coverage was? How did the average New Zealander respond to that news that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated?
Well, I think we were a bit like most Americans. We were saddened by the events. He was a nice, a pleasant young man who was, at that stage, as far as we could see from here, doing a reasonable job, well-liked by the population. He was well-liked and respected by New Zealanders, and we were, very, very saddened and very disappointed. It's one of those things that they talk about. Everybody knows what they were doing or where they were when they heard of Kennedy's death. I can remember I was helping some friends. I think we were making a product on a farm called silage, which is basically a compressed grass feed that they feed to cattle. And somebody came wandering in and said, "Have you heard that Kennedy's been assassinated?" So, I can remember sitting on a tractor doing the work when I first heard about it. So.
Okay. And what about when you were in school and were taking classes, say, in history and current events perhaps, how much discussion was there about the Cold War, the communist threat, and things of that nature?
Very little. Our history tended to be, although I wasn't a history student after my first 2 years in high school, our history tended to be the ancient civilizations and then led a little bit into New Zealand history, but from what I see now and what I read now, we were taught very little history. Quite a reasonable amount of history of the British history, remembering we were a very, very British colony in the 50s and 60s. We were British to the core. To the point where people talked about, and I'm talking about people who were born in New Zealand, second, third generation New Zealanders who were going to go to England, they talked about going home to England. That's the way it was put.
Wow.
So the history of places like the United States, nothing. Nothing at all.
And how about just in terms of your own awareness? How much about that Cold War dynamic between the United States and the Soviet Union, and, of course, what led up to the attempts at containing communism in Southeast Asia, how aware of that were you before you actually went into the military?
I knew very little about it. We had troops in Malaya and Singapore and Borneo at the time repelling the communist terrorists. We knew they were there. We knew the Cold War existed by virtue of the fact of the Berlin Wall and the things that were happening in Europe. But to get into the intimate details of it, we got very little of it. We understood, of course, that there was the always the nuclear threat, and I think we we, like the rest of the world, probably lived in the shadow of that. Mm-hmm. As a as a young man growing up, my interest was in aeroplanes and aviation, and of course we read as much as we could and studied what we could about the aircraft that were being used by the Americans, because the Russian stuff was staying fairly secret. Mm-hmm. So we knew what was going on from that point of view, but to get into the political implications and the individuals and the actual countries involved, we knew very little.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you decide to join the military?
One day when I had nothing better to do.
What year was that?
1966. Let me try and explain this to you. We had at that time in this country what we referred to as national service. Now, national service was like the draft, except that it was done by selective ballot, and that they balloted so many birth dates per year to obtain the appropriate number of young men to serve. At the age of 20, you had to register. Or I think before your 20th birthday, you had to register. If your birthday came up, you went off to do national service. Now, national service was 14 weeks long. That was it. You went in, you did your 14 weeks training, then you were sent off, posted to what we call a territorial, what you would probably call a reserve unit, and for the next 3 years, you did 20 days per year, 14 of them in one camp and the other 6 days on weekend camps. Then your territorial or reserve commitment was over and you were left to go. That was it. So one thing you could actually do in New Zealand is, if you wanted to, you could volunteer to do national service when you signed up to go into the ballot, which was compulsory. There was a little box you could tick it. Do national service. And a lot of young men decided, well, here's the opportunity, I'll go and do national service. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. I volunteered and went and did my national service.
Okay. How much...
Now,
I'm sorry.
Sorry, ask the question?
No, I was just going to say, did you think at that point when you volunteered for your national service that you might go to Southeast Asia, to Vietnam?
No, last thing on my mind. I'd spent 2 years cruising around the country, working in all sorts of places in the lower North Island and then into the South Island, and I went back home to my to live with my parents again. I was working in the local dairy factory, doing all sorts of shift work and that sort of stuff, and then I thought, well, here's the opportunity, I'll go and join the army for 14 weeks, with the chance to get out of here and do something different. See, the other thing I might point out is that, sorry, this may sound a bit disjointed, but the high school that I went to, when you went to high school in 1958 in New Zealand, we had what was called military drill, and it was compulsory. You went to high school at the age of, I think I would have been just coming up 13, and the first week at school was military drill, a solid week of military training, drilling, weapons training, all that sort of thing. And you had to not to do it, you had to have an exemption for a reasonable reason, you needed letters from your parents so that you didn't have to do military drill. So we all did military drill. I did 5 years military drill. By the time I got to do my national service, we all knew exactly what we had to do. Parading, the general format of a parade on a parade ground, we all knew it. They just sort of polished up what we knew, and away we went. So being in a military type situation was nothing new to us at that particular age.
And what about your family? I'm just going to ask you, what about your family? Did your did your father, your uncles, or other family members serve in the military?
My father served in both the Army and the Air Force during World War II. He did not see service overseas. He was injured before the war, and they put him in a... he was posted to a unit to learn to fly aircraft, because at the time he was driving... he was a bus driver, and I think the thinking was that if he was capable of driving a bus, then he was capable of flying an aeroplane, but his injury was such that it precluded him from really getting into the flying and getting overseas, so he was then posted to a coast watch unit, I think probably an artillery battery and an anti-aircraft battery on the coast, where he saw out most of his war years. So he never saw service overseas. I think he lost, from the best I can ascertain within the family, we lost one of his cousins, aircrew over Europe during World War II. And the ironic part about that is that that person's father was also killed in Europe in World War I. It's one of those situations where I think it was the son he never saw who was then killed overseas. So the family does not have a great military history.
Okay. What, you had started to say something else when I interrupted you. Did you want to continue?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, what was the training like? Where did you go, and how were you trained when you entered your national service?
Right. We were posted off as a bulk group. I think there was probably 300 of us. We were sent to a place called Waiuru, which is in the central North Island of New Zealand. Basically, to get there, they had a system where they wanted the entire 300 of us to arrive there at the same time. So we went by a circuitous route, but when I got on the bus, it was a special bus. When I got on the bus in Edgecombe with my, with the equipment that I was to take with me, here were my schoolmates, guys that I'd gone to Whakatane High School with, who had, some of them had volunteered, most of them had been caught up in the draft. So I knew these guys, and then we went down to, we went to Rotorua by bus, and then we joined a whole crowd in Rotorua, then we were bussed to Hamilton, which is actually heading in the wrong direction. It's heading away from Waiuru, where we got on a train, which had left Auckland with the Aucklanders and the North Aucklanders, so that we all arrived in Waiuru freezing bloody cold at 6 o'clock in the morning on the, I think on the 4th of January or the 3rd of January 1967. And the funny part about it is the middle of summer, and it was freezing. And, you get the typical army sergeants, and you always get a wagon amongst the... and amongst the intake, and one guy turned to the sergeant. He said, "Sergeant, where we came from, it's summer. What's happening down here?" And the sergeant, quite looking straight in the eye, says, "Sorry, son, you missed it. It was yesterday." So we were into national service. The training I thought was quite good. We were basically we were compelled to succeed at our training, because if you didn't succeed, you came back and did it again. The different part here is that national service was controlled by the Labor Department in New Zealand and not by the Army. The moment the Labor Department did everything to put you into Waiuru, the moment you arrived at the military camp, you become part of the Army, but the Labor Department got you there. It was the Labor Department, well, they have a different name now, which I won't go into, but the Labor Department called you up, the Labor Department sent you off for medicals and all that sort of stuff, so that it had nothing to do with the military. I don't think the military really were that interested in having national servicemen, but it was something that was done. It was, should have been done for, I don't know how many years. I was on intake number 16, so it had been going, and they do 3 a year, so it had been going for a while. The other thing to remember is that while we were doing an intake in Waiuru, there was another group of a similar number doing an intake in Christchurch, which is south of Christchurch.
Okay. And how long did this training last total? The first training?
14 weeks. 100 days.
Okay. And what kind of weapons training and tactical training did you receive while you were there?
Well, basically, all New Zealand soldiers, regardless of whether they are regular force or territorial force, the basic training is infantry training.
Mm-hmm.
We are all infantry first, and then we go to our other various trades as an offshoot of that. So the weapons training is quite good. We used a weapon called the SLR, which is the self-loading rifle, which was an Australian-built version of the Belgian FN, a semi-automatic version of the Belgian FN. That was our principal infantry weapon. A good, robust, reliable 7.62mm fired the NATO ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 20 round with a standard 20-round magazine on it. A good weapon. I think from memory that the automatic weapons we fired were the old faithful Bren gun, which was the old .303 mm-hmm. World War II Bren gun. So that was the basic weapon training. We did drilling, we did a bit of, you know, quite a reasonable amount of tactical stuff, a few exercises. Then after I think about 8 weeks we were posted. We were then sent to the various schools around Wairu to do the advanced training. Depending on what you were going to do, infantry had more advanced training on different weapons and stuff. Engineers did their thing. The artillery were, you know, were trained in the guns and the radios and whatever was going on there. Now, the other... just before we were sent, we did the basic training, and then we did what was called core training. I think, like I say, basic training was about 8 weeks. Core training was probably 6 weeks, around about those figures. Just before the end of basic training, they came to us and they said, well, you know, here are your options. This is what you are obliged to do. You are now obliged to do your 20 days per year, etc. Said, there is one other option that we have for you. If you would like to sign on and do 1 year in the Army, one full year in the Army, we will release you from your territorial commitment so that you don't have to do the weekend camps and the annual camps. And I thought, this sounds like a good sort of a scheme. So I signed up to just basically to stay in the Army for 1 year. I was actually enjoying the Army life. It was quite good. So I decided to sign up for 1 year so that when I had got out of the Army at the end of the year, I was finished with the Army, had nothing more to do with it. So I went to them and I said, well, where will I, if I sign up, where will I get posted? My initial posting was to the local, when I say local, I mean the local Edgecombe or Bay of Plenty battalion, six battalion Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment. And I said, now, if I sign up for 12 months, where are you guys going to send me? They said, you can go anywhere you like. You tell us where you want to go and we will send you there. So I said to them, right, what is the nearest military camp to my home in Edgecombe? The guy just said, Papakura. So I said, fine. What have you got in Papakura? They said, well, we can send you to the 161 Battery Depot. We'll send you there, and you know, you can spend the rest of your time there, and then you're free to go. Okay, that's fine by me. So I changed from the infantry. Well, I really hadn't become part of the infantry, but they changed the colour of my beret, and then I did artillery training. They said, well, I said to the guy when he was talking to me, what sort of jobs do they have? You know, what sort of things? He said, well, you got the choice of being a gun number, which is a, you know. But remembering at this stage, I was, what am I, 5'10", and I weighed 140 pounds. So there wasn't an awful lot of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy said, well, you got the choice of being a technical assistant, which is the the guys who plot the targets, or you can be a gun number of the guys who fire the guns, or you can be a radio operator for the guys that call the shots, and you get out and about. So I said, fine, that sounds like a piece of me. I'll become a radio operator. And that was, the choice was made about as quick as I've told you about it. So they posted me to, when I had finished my national service, I was posted to 161 Battery Depot, Papua Military Camp, along with two other guys that had also done national service, and a fourth guy on the national service intake that I was on was posted to the infantry in Burnham, which is just south of Christchurch. And the ironic part about it is that at one stage in Vietnam, we actually all sat down together and had a beer. So we all made it to Vietnam quite, some of it, I think it was probably in sometime mid-68. So that's how I got to get to Papakura Military Camp.
And did you receive any additional training while you were there?
As soon as I got to Papakura, I went. The first thing I did was went on to another radio operator's course. I'd already done one at Wairuru, and as soon as I walked into Papakura, and they were just finishing one, so I did some, I think what you call boning up on some of the information and the couple of little items that I hadn't done, and then sat the test for that. I think that was for one star or something, sat the test for that, and then sort of a couple of weeks after that, we were straight back to Wairuru, which is the where all the firing ranges are for the artillery, and we went straight back down there and did an exercise. And then back to Papakura. So, no, training was ongoing.
Okay.
But what it was, 161 Battery Depot, as it was actually called there, was the training depot for the infantry unit, for the artillery unit, which was currently serving in Vietnam.
Okay.
So the training was specifically designed at Vietnam, at nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Were there specific things incorporated into your activities that were coming back from Vietnam, you know, like for instance New Zealand units that were already in country and engaging in activities, were they sending back lessons learned that you guys could incorporate in that training?
Very definitely. The instructors were probably all, with the odd exception, they were all had served in Vietnam. Now, can I just stop you here on that and let me explain to you how New Zealand got to Vietnam?
Absolutely.
Right. Let's just stop there for a moment. In the early part of 1965, as part of our CETO, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, commitments, I think we were invited to join your party. Basically, they said, well, we've got this little scrap going in Vietnam and we'd quite appreciate a little bit of help from you, New Zealand, and Australia. So the Australians decided to send an infantry battalion, and New Zealand decided to send an artillery battery. Now, you must remember, in 1965, New Zealand had a standing army of about 5,000 soldiers, of which about 1,200, probably somewhere between 20 and 25% of them, were serving in Malaya and Singapore and Borneo. So it didn't really leave an awful lot of options for the government when it came to sending troops to Vietnam. So they decided to send an artillery battery, and when they did send this battery, it was a short battery. It only had four guns instead of the normal six guns that were sent over there. The other point is that, we'll send some soldiers, and I think the Australians did exactly the same thing, according to what I've read. We'll send you these guys, but please don't get too many of them killed because we can't really afford to, lose too many. And as if you read a book, if you get hold of a book called Unheralded Victory and read that, it explains a little bit more in there about the fact that, the fact that if the United States Army was to lose a battalion of men, it would be a tragedy, an utter tragedy. Australia was to lose a battalion of men, or New Zealand was to lose its artillery battery, it would be a total disaster. Remembering the size of the country, 3 million people, just over 3 million people. They were sent off, added to the 173rd Airborne, but you'd just be a little careful with them, and I think it probably frustrated the guys who went in the initial group in July of 1965, because they weren't supposed to be, you know, out there fronting up to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, although we did manage to sort of get to where we wanted to be towards the end. But that was the situation. We didn't have a huge army, and we didn't have a lot of people that we could send. That tended to come later, as in the United States. There was those that didn't want us to send troops to Vietnam. We had the protest and all that sort of thing. Basically the same as what you had over there, just on a smaller scale. So that's how we got to be there. And then sometime in 66, the Australians sent another battalion plus another artillery battery. New Zealand increased its commitment, sent a full battery, and then the Australian New Zealanders became the first Australian task force, which was then sent down to the Phuc Thuy province and based at a place called Nui Dat. Well, Nui Dat is just a little, Nui Dat meaning small hill, was just a dot on the map, and we built this, they built a base camp around it, which eventually swelled to have something like about 5,500 troops in it.
Okay. What about the, sorry?
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, any questions on that?
Oh, well, I guess you mentioned that New Zealanders were not really supposed to get into the thick of it, I guess.
That's right. The one thing that I probably feel most disappointment about is that we, although we went there and we did the best we could with what we had, I don't think that we really shouldered our share of the burden, took our share of the shit, if you want it to be, you know, if you want me to put it pedantically. We did the best we could with what we had. Now, we are, from experience, we are probably better at the guerrilla warfare, the jungle type warfare that we did, than we are standing there in a large group and you know, toe-to-toe with the 2,000 screaming Vietnamese and cutting them down. We're probably better sneaking through the jungles and picking them off one or two or three at a time, which is what we did, and what we did very, very effectively, because by the time the Tet Offensive came along, we'd basically cleaned out the Phuc Thuy province, and there was very little guerrilla warfare going on. So at the end, I suppose the powers to be used us to do what we were best at.
Mm-hmm.
It was called search and destroy, I think, is probably the expression that you'd know it as. But basically, we went into the Viet Cong, into their areas, and we went looking for them. And we found them in short, sharp contacts, which was basically all we had. You know, there were no, except for the Battle of Long Tan, which was one of those military sagas that, I don't know what happened. One infantry company walked into about 2,500 North Vietnamese. Most of the other skirmishes were, might have lasted for an hour or more. That was about it.
And what about those instructors that you started talking about that, I guess it ties in with what you were saying as far as New Zealanders not expecting
it. We had two situations. We had these instructors who had mostly been to Vietnam and served in the artillery unit. Mm-hmm. I'm talking from an artillery perspective here.
Mm-hmm.
When I arrived at 161 Battery in 1967, in April of 1967, we also had received a large group of former infantry soldiers, because had been posted there probably in very early, say, February 67, because at that stage there was no infantry presence in Vietnam. And they were running short on men to serve in the battery. So the call went out to the army in general, if you want to serve in Vietnam, if you'd like to go to Vietnam, you've got to join the Royal New Zealand Artillery. So these guys all traipsed up to Papakura Camp. Now, what served us well was the fact that they were infantry. They had, most of them had been to Malaya, had served in Malaya. Some of them had been there twice. But they were hard, regular soldiers. They were good soldiers. And they're the guys that probably taught us more about the jungle craft than the instructors themselves, because these guys, and some of them, you know, I served with a guy who'd been in the army for 8 years. He was still a private. He didn't want to be any more than a private. He was happy being a private. The other thing to remember is that probably 50% of the unit was made up of the our local indigenous population, the Maori, who make up about 10% of the population of the country, and they're good soldiers too. So that's where our basic, I think, from the good instructors that we had with the experience in Vietnam, plus these soldiers who had been to, you know, served in places like Malaya and Borneo, and some of them go back as far as Korea. That's where we got our professionalism from, because I think it was acknowledged. You know, I don't mean to pat myself or my fellow soldiers on the back, but I think it was generally acknowledged that the average New Zealand soldier was probably one of the best in Vietnam, leaving aside the specialist units.
Do you recall anything specific in terms of the jungle craft or the counterinsurgency training that you experienced either by Australia, by New Zealand, trainers that had Vietnam experience, or more importantly, perhaps, the Malayan soldiers, the soldiers that had experienced a Malayan emergency?
Well, we're a small country, and from my perspective, I had spent a reasonable amount of time in the countryside, in the bush. The type of living in the bush was not a problem. As I say, we're a fairly small population. The country is reasonably heavily afforested. So, and we live quite easily in our bush, because there is nothing in our bush that will do you any harm. We don't have snakes. We don't have any kind of predators, spiders. The only thing that's likely to do you any harm in New Zealand bush is a spider, and you'd be gone. You'd have a hell of a job finding one of them. So our bush is quite easy to live in. The only thing about it is it doesn't really support you that well. You've got to carry your food with you, because we don't have the berries and fruits and things that other countries do. So we're quite used to living in the bush. It's not a problem to us. Jungle craft, the military jungle craft, well, that was taught to us as part of our training. Patrolling, that was taught to us as part of our training. Infantry tactics, once again, part of our training. Even as an artillery unit, we still did infantry training. We still went on exercises in which we were doing infantry type training.
Okay. And how about, do you remember anybody in particular, the people that you served with before you went to Vietnam, that went through training, maybe some of the Malayan, the soldiers of Malayan experience, or anybody?
Oh, as a group, yeah.
How about specific people, though?
Specific individuals?
Yeah, that you maybe have you contact with still, or something like that?
Well, one chap that I remember is a guy by the name of Bill Cooper, who was my signal sergeant. He was my instructor at Papakura, signals instructor, radio instructor, and I've had dealings with him. I didn't see him for years, and then he was actually serving on the committee that I'm on some time ago, so, see him at reunions and that sort of thing. Some of the others, you bump into them, you've got to remember there's only 3.5, well, there's probably less than 3,000 that's left alive now, so, we're not that... Um, are not that big a group, but you bump mm-hmm. into them from time to time. You know, you look at people and think, oh, I know that guy from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have reunions every couple of years, so we see, you know, people from time to time. There is nobody specific that I am particularly close to.
Mm-hmm.
I had one good friend who is now a, what do they call him, yeoman warden or beef eater at the Tower of London.
Oh.
He and I, you know, spent a lot of time together. I was best man at his wedding, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen him for a few years because he's living in London and I'm living in New Zealand. And,
mm-hmm. Now, is it still considered going back home to England when people travel?
No, not as much as it was then. I think the youth of today, we consider ourselves to be, you know, a nation in our own right now, so
mm-hmm.
we've lost that, but mm-hmm. he just happened to be there and, you know, happened to have all the qualifications to fit into the bill. He'd been a cadet soldier, gone in as what they call a boy entrant or cadet. I don't know, probably 16 or 17, has gone right through. He'd changed course. He'd come from the electrical and mechanical engineers to join the artillery to go to Vietnam, and when he finished his time in Vietnam, he went back to the electrical and mechanical engineers and carried on his military career. The other thing to remember is that in an army like ours, that overseas service, particularly at that stage in a place like Vietnam, was good for your career, particularly for senior NCOs, young officers. It was good for your career. It gave you a couple of medals to pin on your uniform, which put a bit of colour into it. And that's basically why so many went
mm-hmm.
for the experience and the advancement of their military careers.
Okay. And when did you learn that you were going to Vietnam? At what point did you know?
Well, this once again, as I said, I had signed up to stay in the army for my year, to finish my year off.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, it would have been around about the 1st of October, 1967. I got to the point of thinking, well, I've only really got 3 months left of this, you know. And I wasn't unhappy to be there. I was quite enjoying it. Thinking I've only got 3 months of this to go. And I went to parade. On a Monday morning, I went off to collect my rifle and go and join the camp parades that we used to have every Monday morning, which was a traditional thing. And I was told to go to the orderly office. Now, when you get sent to the orderly office, it's not good news. Communications mm-hmm. in those days weren't that brilliant, so if they wanted to. They wanted to find a soldier to tell them that a member of the family was sick or had died or something like that. You were sent to the orderly office, or if you'd done something wrong,
mm-hmm.
you'd been misbehaved, you're sent to the orderly office. So, Gunner Cameron, which was my rank, would you please report to the orderly office? They go, what the hell's happened now? So
mm-hmm.
I traipsed off to the orderly office and stood there, strictly to attention, and all sort of, I said to me, how would you like this? Remembering this is Monday morning, and guy said to me, "How would you like to go to Vietnam?" And I sort of thought, "Well, really, I'm not married. I'm single. I was only 22.
Mm-hmm.
I was single. I had nothing, no commitments, nothing to do." So I thought, "Well, yeah, why not?" I said, "When?" He said, "Friday." So I thought, well, I don't know. So I said to the guy, would you like to talk to somebody about it? I said, well, wouldn't mind sort of talking to my mother. So they rang her up, and I said, told her what was going on. She said, yeah, well, if that's what you want to do. There was no, don't do it, you'll get killed or anything like that. There was no, that's, I understand this. So, okay, I'll go. And that's how I got to go. Because somebody had withdrawn. What we had was what was called the trickle system, when a soldier had finished his 12 months duty in Vietnam, he was sent home and somebody was sent to replace him.
Mm-hmm.
The unit that I belonged to was posted to 161 Battery, was posted to Vietnam in July of 1967. It stayed there for 7 years. It never came home. The troops changed.
Mm-hmm.
So in many respects, it was quite a good idea, although I see reports that it caused bad morale, but I never considered that to be a fact. What happened was you always had a hard core of experienced people there. You know, if you take a military unit like an artillery battery, pick them up off the ground, dump them in Vietnam, it takes them 2 months to build up to being effective, getting used to the climate, getting used to, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then it carries on from there, you know, they're only really effective for 6 months, because after that, then they're sort of looking to go home, so they're keeping their heads down and not going and doing the work that they should do. So a unit like 161 battery that had been posted there and was left there, we had this trickle system, so it was always an experienced unit. You understand what I mean?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so somebody who was doing the same job that I was as a radio operator, for some reason, had to pull out of the flight that was leaving on that particular Friday, and they just looked at who else was in was doing the same trade, and I had topped the class that I had been on, had just recently finished the course I'd finished, and they thought, well, if he wants to go, he can go. So they said, you can go. I had to sign on for another couple of years. I had to sign on to make a total of a 3-year commitment. But that was no problem. Signed the dotted line. Went and had a medical, another medical. Went and had a dental. They put me through a dentist. I had all the fillings. I had 13 fillings and one extraction in 2 days. And in 1967, it wasn't a lot of fun. I could hardly talk. I could hardly eat. But they had to get me dentally and medically fit. And on the Friday, I climbed on the plane on a C-130. I flew to Alice Springs in Australia, where we overnighted. Flew to Singapore, where we overnighted. And then flew up to Vietnam. So in less than from the time I was first told to the time I got there, it was less than a week.
What was your biggest concern about going to Vietnam?
I think it was probably the danger that I was going into. We had the situation where we had some of the some of the older soldiers wound the war up to be a lot more than what it was. I think I had this idea in the back of my mind that when the plane landed, they were going to thrust a rifle into my hands, and I was going to have to fight my way to, you know, to wherever, which was totally untrue. I think it was just a thing that I had, one of those situations you build up in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the circumstances were totally different to that. So, but that, I think that was my greatest fear. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, you've got to realize in the time that I had, I never really had time to think. Like a whirlwind, you get told on on a Monday morning you're going on a Friday, and when I say Friday morning, I, you know, 7 o'clock Friday morning we flew out.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really had time to do too much thinking. My parents came up to Papakura to see me off. The army actually afforded me a little bit of they gave me a little bit of slack. I was supposed to. I wasn't supposed to leave camp from, I think, the Wednesday night on, but on the Thursday they allowed me to go down to a place called Huntley, which is about probably 60 miles south of Papakura, to see a girlfriend that I had at the time and to say goodbye to her, and that was about it. Friday morning I got on the plane and went to Vietnam.
Where did you arrive in country?
We arrived at Tonsonute.
Okay. And what was your first impression when you
basically
got off the plane?
Right. The heat, the noise, and here I am, I really consider myself to be at that stage a real little country boy. I'm standing under the wing of a Hercules that's just brought me there, and here are these phantoms. Voodoos and, you know, all this military hardware taxiing past, and, you know, like a dream come true. I've never seen anything like that before. You know, we did not have that sort of stuff in our Air Force at the time. And here I am interested in aeroplanes and you know, that sort of thing. And here it is, right before my eyes, happening. That was the thing I remember. And the other thing that I remember, and just please try not to take this the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
is that here is this voodoo taxiing out being flown by an, what do you call them, an African-American.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, from what we had observed of America in what we saw, this was not right. How could this black man be flying this airplane? You know, we sort of had this basic idea that they were all second-class citizens instilled in it. I don't know, it's something we, you know, we had gained from what we had seen on in the movies and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
which I soon learned was, you know, quite the reverse. But
so the impression that you had about how African Americans or Black Americans were treated in the United States, your impression was they would not have even been trained to do something like pilot an aircraft, which is a highly technical skill, takes a lot of training.
That was just
something the United States would not invest in for African Americans or Black Americans.
Very true.
Wow.
As I say, that is the distinct impression I gained. You know, it was a surprise to see this guy,
mm-hmm.
Flying this aircraft. It was something, not I won't say totally foreign, but mm-hmm. It was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've read about the groups like the Tuskegee Airmen and that sort mm-hmm. of thing, you know, and the struggle that they had. And I can well imagine the struggle that this gentleman had to get to where he was.
Because
mm-hmm. we're talking here 67, quite early in the piece, so he would have gone through his training, starting probably 63, 64, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall what movies or what gave you that impression about the United States and their policies towards Black Americans?
Not really, no. Okay. No. It's one of those things that is very hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It came as a, mm-hmm. not as a shock, came as a bit of a surprise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The dealings that I had with them mm-hmm. Subsequent to that was excellent. You know, we ran into artillery officers and infantry officers who were, you know, Black Americans. You know, they were skilled,
mm-hmm.
well qualified, you know, good soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other thing to remember, of course, is that as I said, over 50% of our army and the unit I served in were made up of Maori, so we had this understanding of the black and white situation.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in 1965, 67, we lived in reasonable harmony with our with the Maori in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
We were just all New Zealanders, there was no real problem.
Mm-hmm.
They have a different attitude. They tended to have a different attitude towards life than we did.
But mm-hmm.
we integrated. We had no. I do not recall in my time in the military, my 3 years in the military,
mm-hmm.
ever seeing harsh words over colour.
Mm-hmm.
So the integration was pretty complete.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in New Zealand, just out of curiosity, since you've mentioned them, was there any resentment or anything held over from the Maori Wars or anything like that? Was that taught to you, the Maori Wars? Did you learn about it?
We knew they had happened. We knew they existed.
Mm-hmm.
And no, there was nothing. It was just a piece of history that had happened 100 years previous.
Mm-hmm.
100 years previous. And I'm 55. I've never, ever heard or seen or heard of any resentment from white New Zealander to Maori New Zealander or vice versa concerning the actual Maori wars themselves.
Okay. So you get off the plane, Tonsonet. You're surprised by that particular experience.
Yep.
The
Yep.
The African-American, black American piloting that aircraft. Where do you go from there?
We were then flown by Royal Australian Air Force Caribou up to Nui Dat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how good your map is of Vietnam. You find Nui Dat. I've just got to try and work this one out. Nui Dat. If you can find a place called Ba Ria in Phuc Thuy Province, which mm-hmm. is, have you got a map in front of you?
I don't, but I know what you're. I know where you're talking about. Phuc Thuy.
Right. If you go from Bung Tao
mm-hmm.
to Saigon, you go from Bung Tao to Saigon, you go via a place called Ba Ria.
Mm-hmm.
There is a road from Ba Ria which runs north up through a village called Hoa Long, and
mm-hmm.
Nui Dat was built right beside the Hoa Long village.
Okay. Could you spell Nui Dat for me?
N-U-I
mm-hmm.
D-A-T.
Okay. Nui Dat. Okay, so you arrive at Nui Dat, and
yep.
do you receive some kind of a briefing, or what happens when you get there?
you receive... No, there's no such thing as a briefing. You receive a welcome from those that you had already met previous to going to Vietnam, because you trained with them, and what the hell are you doing here, and how's things, and what's going on, and how's
oh.
this, and what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It was like being away from your family for a little while. You're taken, basically, you're shown, in my particular situation, you're shown where you sleep, which would have been a big tent with a partially sandbag walls and a wooden floor, and then we're shown the command post and where you're going to work, issued with the necessary equipment in this particular case, issued with a self-loading rifle, introduced to those people that you're going to work with that you don't know, in my case it was most of them, and that was it. Come down to the command post on such and such a time, and we'll show you where everything is, how everything works. You can sit in and listen to what's going on, and that's it.
Okay.
So I say our army was so small that if you went to any of the army bases in New Zealand, there was probably only about 8 or 10 of them all through the country. You always knew somebody on that particular base.
Mm-hmm.
If you went to the mess for a meal, there
mm-hmm.
would be somebody that you knew there, or had seen, or or knew of, or somebody who knew you. So you were, it was like just a huge family.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, would you give me the unit, the complete unit designation where you were assigned down to the lowest level?
Right, I was was 161 Field Battery
mm-hmm.
of 16 Field Regiment.
Was that not broken down into platoons, or...?
No,
okay.
No, because as a radio operator, I was just... the battery is made up of 6 guns,
mm-hmm.
a command element, then it has a group of signalers, radio operators,
mm-hmm.
who they work at both ends, up at one lot at the sharp end, one lot at the command post.
Mm-hmm.
Then it has a group of what is actually called battery surveyors,
mm-hmm.
who were the guys who plotted the targets. We refer to them as battery surveyors. They were also called technical assistants. They had a variety of names, but they're
mm-hmm.
the guys that plotted the targets.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And basically, we were all 161 batteries.
I'm sorry, you were all what?
We were all just 161 batteries.
Oh, okay.
We were just, There's only 100 and... I think at the peak there was probably only 130 of us in the whole unit.
Okay. How many men to operate a gun? And what size guns were they?
105mm howitzers,
mm-hmm.
and they have a 6-man gun crew.
Okay.
Probably, I think in Vietnam, each gun actually had 8 or 9 assigned crew, so that there was always a 6-man crew available with guys who were on leave
mm-hmm.
or doing other duties or whatever.
Okay.
So we have a funny, we operate a funny system in that with the guns is that the first man to the gun when the fire mission is called gets the good job.
Okay.
The last man there get the job of lugging the ammunition. You've got to remember, one thing I should have pointed out about New Zealanders is that we are a very versatile race. We can do, we will do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to my arriving at Papakura at 161 Battery, we had exchanged units with a British unit from the Royal Artillery, and some of our people had gone to England to, I think, to guard the Tower of London for a few days or something as a, some kind of honour.
Hmm.
And so being artillery, they went and joined the Royal Artillery for, you know, for an exercise. And the guys that went said that they found that the British artillery, the one guy who was the gun layer who sighted through the target, he was the gun layer. That's all he did. He did nothing else. So if he fell over, then they had to wait for him to get to the gun to do his job.
Mm-hmm.
They were very, you know, one man, one job. Our guys were first man there gets the good job.
Mm-hmm.
Last guy out of bed gets to lug the ammunition. And that's the way we've always been. But we'll do anything. We'll have a go at anything.
Mm-hmm.
In actual fact, in one fire support base that I was in, they brought in, we were having a spot of strife, so they brought in what your guys called the dusters, which I think were 240mm anti-aircraft cannons mounted on tracks, and some of the guys went down to have a look at these things. They wanted to, the Maori has a word, it is actually tutu, I think it's spelled T-U-T-U, it's a probably a bit of a bastardization of another word, tutu. It means play. So they will go down, they went down to have a tutu with these guns.
Mm.
And that's what they would go, and that's what they would say. Hey, they would walk down there and say to whoever was operating, hey, can we have a tutu? Meaning, can we have a drive? Can we have a play? Can we see how it works?
Mm-hmm.
So, and they would be serious about it too. You know, if you let them loose, they'd want to drive it right around the fire support base. So very, very versatile people. We will have a go at anything. In those days, we would have a go at anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this, when you arrived at the unit, how was the morale?
Good. Excellent. Everybody seemed happy. We're, you know, when I arrived, the battery was back in its base camp at Nui Dat, so we were living off prepared food coming from kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
These days, you wouldn't call it that exciting because it was all, the type of rations it was. But it was wholesome. There was plenty of it. You know. Food, I think, from my point of view, from what I could see, if the food was good, and everybody was basically behaving themselves, and we were getting our two cans of beer per man per day,
mm-hmm.
There was no major problems. So I think when I got there, morale was pretty good.
What was the biggest problem facing the unit in terms of either morale or equipment or misbehavior?
I don't think we from
were there no problems.
Well, we had a problem from, I think the battery commander will tell you that he had a problem that the infantry soldiers that had been sent to make up the numbers, some of them were pretty hard case.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, the odd rat bag amongst them, but they were generally, we had this tendency to look after our own, and to be quite honest, it's something that's carried on right through to today, where we go to a reunion, and somebody will get, you know, will have a few too many drinks, and his mates will just take him aside and put him to bed, do whatever. We look after our own. We don't
mm-hmm.
let our own guys get into trouble. They may get into trouble amongst ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't, we keep our affairs pretty strictly to ourselves. So, we, you know, there's the odd rat bag in amongst it. Yeah. No real problems.
Okay. And what was the... what was your leadership like? Was it?
Well, it was good because we're talking about professional officers.
Mm-hmm.
To be a sergeant in the New Zealand Army, you probably would have had to have been in the thick end of 8, 9, maybe even 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The officers were all professional. They'd been through the either the British or the Australian system. We didn't have our own officer training school, so they went to generally went to Australia to learn to be officers. So very, very professional.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a little bit, the officers were a little bit what the British would call upper crust.
Mm-hmm.
There was a distinct line between the officers and the men. There was not a lot of fraternization between the officers and the men. It was something along the lines of the British class system.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a problem because we knew it existed. We didn't have a problem with discipline because we knew where we stood. If they drew a line in the sand,
mm-hmm.
and you put your toes over the line, they'd chop your toes off. Just that was it. There was no grey areas with discipline. You misbehaved, you got caught, you got punished. Simple as that.
Okay.
And it was the system. What was good about it is you knew exactly what was going to happen. If you did something wrong, you knew you were going to get punished for it, and you knew basically what the punishment was going to be.
Yes, sir. Okay. And what, being an artillery battalion, what units, what forces did your battery provide fire support for?
Right. Okay. The Australians,
mm-hmm.
prior to my, hang on, when I arrived, the task force was made up, excuse me, just now, I'm just going to have a drink of water.
Yeah.
What?
Uh-huh, right here.
Right, hang on just a second.
Okay. You're a little bit staticky.
Hang on. Right, that better?
Yes, sir, that's great.
Okay. Right, now, hang on. What I was about to say is that when I arrived,
mm-hmm.
the Australians had two infantry companies. The task force was made up of two infantry battalions and three artillery batteries. Now, the two Australian batteries were supporting the two Australian battalions. And the New Zealand battery was in what is called general support. So I don't know what the battery numbers were, and I can't in actual fact remember what the infantry battalion numbers were. But there was one Australian battery in direct support of another Australian battalion. Now, that happened twice, and the New Zealanders were the general support battery for the other two. So we could get called to fire on the whatever was going on.
Mm-hmm.
In December and January of 1967-1968, the 3rd Battalion, or the 3rd Battalion, which was actually 3 Battalion Royal Australia Regiment, arrived, and we went into direct support of that particular battalion. One of the reasons for it was the fact that we had been in direct support of that battalion at a battle in Korea. So there was a traditional thing. So that when 3 RA, as they're referred to, RA being Royal Australian Regiment, when 3 RA arrived, 161 Battery went into direct support of 3 RA. And so we had 3 batteries and 3 battalions.
Okay. You don't remember which battalion your battery supported?
Before that, no. I remember going and spending time with, I think it was 7 RA. I spent some time in the field with 7 RA.
Mm-hmm.
And I know at one stage I spent a very short operation or short patrol with 2 RA. So they were just jobs you were just sent out to do, and you went out on either you helicoptered, I think it was helicoptered in to replace somebody who was going on leave,
mm-hmm.
and you just went and patrolled, did whatever you had to do, and went back to wherever.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much special training, how much additional training did you receive when you arrived in Vietnam?
Absolutely none. When we got there, we were ready to go.
Okay. So what was your job as a radio operator in your unit?
Right. When I first arrived, I was sent into the command post to receive the artillery fire missions. That was my job.
Mm-hmm.
I sat in the command post with two technical assistants and the gun position officer. Mm-hmm. That was the command post staff. And when a fire mission came in, I received it on the radio. I wrote it. I logged it in the book I had.
Mm-hmm.
And then I passed the information on to the two technical assistants, one of each who were standing on either side of me. They plotted the target individually. The information was then collated by the gun position officer who was standing there, who then relayed it out to the guns, who then fired.
Okay. And when was the first time you did that, your call? How long had you been with the unit?
Probably only a couple of days.
Okay. And was it was there a lot of activity the first time you received?
No, it was a little bit. It was a little bit intermittent to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, we were firing in, we were in general support, so we could get called upon to fire for either of the two Australian battalions that were there, depending on where our forward observers are,
mm-hmm.
or were. The other thing, of course, to remember is that we did not really allow infantry officers to call artillery.
Mm.
We generally had to have a properly trained, formally trained artillery forward observer to call that artillery fire down.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did allow infantry officers to do it for themselves, there we had incidents where artillery landed in the wrong place, where we killed friendly forces. You know, it appeared to be that the nasty incidents happened when the wrong people were doing the wrong job.
Were there specific incidents of friendly fire kills while you were there?
Yes.
Was that when you were receiving fire missions or when you were out as a forward observer?
Fortunately for me, I was not directly involved in any of the incidents that occurred.
Okay. You were always out in the field when they occurred?
Either out in the field or away from the command post. In other words, not actually on duty in the command post at the time.
Okay. When those, do you recall approximately how many times that happened?
Probably two or three.
How did that affect your unit when that happened? When your unit.
That generally tends to toss the morale around a little bit. You get unhappy about you get down because you've actually done some damage to your own your own forces, your comrades in arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that ever makes anybody particularly happy, of course. But it's one of those things that tends to drop morale down, and all those incidents are investigated, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out that as to where the error was made to allow the artillery to land where it did.
Mm-hmm.
We suffered at one stage. We had artillery. We were shelled in one position by the South Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem we had with it is that while we were receiving the stuff, we didn't know how to stop it.
Mm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You just can't call up on the radio and say, whoever's shelling us, stop you. We didn't know where it was coming from. We knew it wasn't Viet Cong or anything because of the size of the stuff coming in. And we took half a dozen rounds before it finally stopped. But after each of these incidents, somebody's head rolls. We had officers that had given permission to allow fire to come down to where it shouldn't have been, were lost seniority and this sort of thing,
When you say that those rounds were coming in, are you talking about in your where the 161 was positioned or out?
No, actually, the incident I refer to actually happened in the field in a fire support base.
Okay. Did your base camp ever come under fire? And your artillery?
The odd stray round. We didn't. During the Tet Offensive, we took a little bit, but not enough to get anybody too worried about.
You never lost any guns?
No, not. Our base camp was very, very well. The defences around our base camp were great. You know, huge sandbag buns. The command post was underground with probably could have taken the next best thing to a nuclear explosion before the roof would have caved in. Everything, yeah. As I said, we were professional soldiers, and we had this policy of overhead cover, sleeping under overhead cover, except at Nui Dat. You know, everything, we were well protected. We had quite a large barbed wire area out in front of us, which actually had mines in it, a tower on top of a container with a 50 caliber machine gun. We were fairly well protected, or what we thought was fairly well protected anyway.
And how long was it that you were stationed where you received fire missions before you actually went out into the field yourself as a forward observer?
Probably about 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and talk about your first experience out in the field?
What happened? I got sent to relieve one of my, another New Zealander who was serving with, I think it was 7th Battalion, one of the companies in 7th Battalion, because he was due to go on leave, so they flew me into the bush in a Bell 47, which was loaded with plastic explosives because they'd discovered some tunnels. And this was the way they decided that, you know, we swapped the radio operator, we'll send him in with the explosives, because I remember getting into this helicopter with this red-headed Australian flying it, and he put the little headset on, and I could hardly understand a word he was saying. And he basically told me that if I yell at you, he said, you start firing that stuff out the door, meaning the plastic explosives was under my feet. He said, you just kick it out the door, we don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he flew me into this area, and I got off the helicopter, exchanged equipment with the guy that was flying back out, the radio and spare batteries and that sort of stuff, and then just went on patrolling with the Australians.
How long did you stay out with them?
I think from memory, it was probably about a week, probably a little bit more than a week.
Did you make much enemy contact?
We ran into an ambush. That's what I... for some reason, this particular time is... I think the memory's getting a bit vague, but I know we ran into an ambush and we were hit by some very large claymore mines, homemade claymore mines, that had a tendency to make a mess of the surrounding jungle. But basically, the thing that I remember most from that is the offshoot of it is that I contracted malaria from that particular operation.
Well, what? Just out of curiosity, what do you remember about the contact?
Just the noise and the shit and the yelling and screaming that went on. That was basically it.
Okay. Any? Were you able to call in some artillery strikes against the enemy forces and?
Well, that was automatically, basically, as soon as something happened, we just went to ground.
Mm-hmm.
I had to cover the territory between me and the forward observer. I had to establish communications with the battery. Mm-hmm. Now, at times that might be fairly difficult, so you're trying to pull up aerials and you're lying on your back, with a bit of stuff going across the top of you in the trees, lying on your back, trying to pull an aerial up or get an aerial up or get communications or find somebody that you can talk to relay the missions. And at the same time, I've got to get to the forward observer, who in turn has got to get to the company commander, because we patrolled in company strength. So you were pretty busy, unless there was, you know, unless you could hear the stuff pretty close to you, you didn't take an awful lot of notice of it. So, had a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
Was well trained, as far as I was concerned, I was well trained at doing that job. And you just went ahead and did it. I think training takes over when, you know, if you're well trained, when incidents like that happen, training takes over. You just do what you've got to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you within the formation itself, well, I guess first things first, night mission or day mission?
Day. Patrol by day, mm-hmm. ambush, and put out ambushes by night.
Okay. When in your position within the patrol itself, you weren't already right next to the forward observer? And he, in turn, was not already the company commander?
Well, I would have been either in front of him or behind him because the forward observer had two radio operators.
Okay.
And so there would have been one ahead of him and one behind him. The company commander would have been ahead of the first radio operator,
mm-hmm.
but between him and that would have been another radio operator belonging to the company commander. So he was a reasonable... And we this is where our training came in. We mm-hmm. never stood together.
Mm-hmm.
There would always be, depending on how heavy the jungle was, there would always be a reasonable gap between me and the guy in front of me. In
mm-hmm.
an open territory, it could be as much as some places, sort of 30, 40, 50 yards at times.
Mm-hmm.
But we never patrol side by side, shoulder to shoulder. We were, you know, once again, that's our training came in.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there was a reasonable distance to cover.
Now, and did you have radio contact with the company RTO?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had, like I say, we had two radios. One was generally on the company frequency,
mm-hmm.
and the other was on the battery frequency, so we could hear.
Mm-hmm.
When the platoon, the company split into platoons, of course, we could hear what the platoon, what was happening to the platoon,
mm-hmm.
as well as talk back to the guns. At times we would change frequencies on to gain whatever communications we needed. We got pretty adept at working out where we had to be and
mm-hmm.
how. You know. But we would, see, we knew basically, when you were walking, you knew basically what communications were like, because every couple of hours we would send what was called a LOCSTAT or location statement back to the battery so they could mark us on their map so they knew about
mm-hmm.
where we were.
Okay.
All sent in code, of course,
mm-hmm.
nothing out in free. All sent in code. So they knew where we were, so you would have a fair idea that communications were, you know, the little area were impossible, if the big area were so-so. At times, we had to basically toss aerials, you know, dipole aerials up into trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You became an expert at aerials in the end.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, and what kind of aerial would you toss into the trees?
Oh, the thing called a dipole.
Okay. And this was just...
That's a wire. It's a wire aerial that,
mm-hmm.
You know, basically looked like a T. If you laid it out on the ground, it looked like a T. You hook the bottom of the T into the radio.
And let's see, in terms of the operation itself, what area, for this first operation, what area was this? Was this still in Phuc Thuy, or?
I'd be in Phuc Thuy. I wouldn't have it. Honestly, wouldn't have a clue as to where it was.
Mm-hmm. And did you know what kind of enemy units you were going up against?
They were just local Viet Cong.
Viet Cong? Okay.
Yep.
All right, so you're...
I think it was 274 Regiment and 445 or something were the numbers of the two regiments we had problems with. 274, 275, and D445.
Those are the units that you were with.
No, those are the Viet Cong units.
Oh, those are the Viet Cong units in the area. Okay,
this yeah.
274th, 275th, and D445.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So when they broke that ambush, what happened?
Yep. An awful lot of firing, an awful lot of shouting, and not a lot of casualties. I think there were a couple of Aussies hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That was about it. I don't think I don't think we got any.
How long did it last?
Oh, 5 minutes at the most.
Wow.
Just enough to let you know that you were, you know, in
mm-hmm.
the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
See, we had this tendency, we did not patrol on tracks or paths.
Mm-hmm.
because you can booby trap tracks and paths. So we just went wherever we just went wherever we could. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Let's have a look. The VC formed D445 Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And 1st Battalion of 274 Regiment.
Okay.
I think that's what they were. That's just out of another book that I just looked that up in the book as I'm talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the incidents we had were basically, the contacts we had were very short, very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Casualties were generally restricted on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the... depending on the circumstances and the jungle that we were in as to how many of the enemy you could actually see at any one time.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you be part of the briefing when you went out on these types of missions in support of the Australian forces? Would you receive an intelligence brief?
We were told what we needed to know.
Okay.
We would get told where we were going,
mm-hmm.
and not very much about what we expected to find.
Okay.
That was generally kept for... we weren't kept in the dark. We didn't get that sort of treatment, but basically, as far as I was concerned, as a radio operator, what I wanted to know was the briefing that I would get from the forward observers, where the guns were, the frequencies... the codes, the SOIs, that sort of stuff, what I needed to know to do my job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, let's see. Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about with regard to that first experience out in the field, or did you want to move on?
No, I think we'll move on from that.
Okay. Well, let's see. Well, I guess a good question would be: what was your opinion and impression of the Vietnamese enemy before you arrived in Vietnam, and then based on your experiences in Phuc Thuy, did they change at all? Did your opinion of the enemy change?
Well, I didn't really have an impression of the before I arrived. I had absolutely no idea
mm-hmm.
of what we were, what I was likely to strike a lot with, what we were likely to walk into.
Mm-hmm.
My general impression of the two different enemies that we had, because we had the Viet Cong
mm-hmm.
and we had the NVA.
Yes.
The Viet Cong were, as far as I could ascertain, poorly trained, badly equipped, and poor tactically, quite poor.
Mm-hmm.
The NVA, on the other hand, were reasonably well trained, reasonably well equipped, and they were, I don't know whether they pumped them up on drugs or what they did, but they were, the Viet Cong, you fire a couple of shots at them, they were gone. The NVA, they stood and they stood and fought.
Mm-hmm. And what about the South Vietnamese military, ARVN? Did you interact
had very, with them? Had very little to do with them, but from what I can understand, the troops depended on their leadership. If they had good leaders, they were good troops. If they had bad leaders, they were they were poor.
Mm-hmm.
Tactically, I think they let us down a little bit, and they I don't think they were too much of a help. Generally, I have read Neil Sheehan's book, A Bright Shining Lie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read that book.
Yes, sir.
It takes it's basically what I get from the book is the fact that we used the intelligence information we had to go hunt the enemy down.
Mm-hmm.
The South Vietnamese Army used the intelligence information they had to stay away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of that doesn't sort of please you. As a soldier, that doesn't really please you too much, so...
Well, what about your own experience, though, based on your...
I had very little to... had nothing to do with them.
Okay.
From a combat point of view, we never operated with them, amongst them or anything.
Okay. How about other countries' forces? The Koreans, the Americans?
We operated with the Americans from the point of view that we were part of the Allied offensive that was there. We had attached to us at Nui Dat as part of the task force a battery, second of the 35th U.S. Artillery,
mm-hmm.
and we had a battery of the first of the 83rd Artillery. I think it was first of the 83rd, second of the 83rd. So we had some self-propelled 155s
mm-hmm.
and the first of the 83rd or second of the 83rd, I'm too sure which it was. They had some 175 howitzers, some 175 long toms and 8-inch howitzers.
Mm-hmm.
So we operated with American forces from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But generally it was just us and the Australians.
Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss some of the other operations? What was perhaps the most memorable operation for you that you went on?
Well, I was involved in what was called Tone Fang, which was the operation started sometime in April of '68. And went through May and into June, at which time the Australians changed their tactics and decided we'd had a reasonable amount of success in the Phuc Thuy province. So they sent us northwest of Saigon, somewhere up almost into around about Hobo Woods. And they set us up in a couple of fire support bases. We put two fire support bases reasonably close together, so we had mutual protection. And the North Vietnamese made a very reasonable attempt at walking through us. They put us on the road, or on the virtually the path between the between Saigon and the Cambodian border, and then told us that we were there to clean up the stragglers as they came back from Saigon, because there'd been a couple of attacks in Saigon in May of '68. So we were stuck there as a, go out there and clean up the stragglers, you'll be pretty good at it. But what they didn't tell us is that the stragglers hadn't actually gone past in the other direction first, so we got the main strength NVA, had a couple of goes of walking clean through us. Now, From our point of view as a battery, I had actually at this stage was back with the battery as a command post radio operator. We suffered no casualties in the operation whatsoever, which wasn't unusual for us. We were in fire support bases, like in the Tet Offensive, we were at a fire support base called Anderson, just up slightly north of Benoit. When we suffered a couple of really serious North Vietnamese attacks, we had Australians right beside us killed, we had Americans the other side of us killed, and we would suffer no casualties at all. I don't know why, whether we suffered from the luck of the Irish or what it was, but we dug ourselves in fairly well, fairly quickly,
mm-hmm.
and the same thing happened at it's generally referred to as the Battle of Coral.
Could you spell that, please?
C-O-R-A-L.
Mm-hmm, okay.
The Battle of Coral, and there was actually three fire support bases involved in it. Coral, Balmoral, and Coogee. And during that period, I think it lasted from early May into early June. It was probably the greatest battle, or the greatest intensity of combat that the Australians had in the whole time of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The Australians lost 25 killed in the 3.5 weeks or whatever it is of that particular tenure in that place.
Mm-hmm.
New Zealand suffered no casualties at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
So No, that's probably the nastiest scrap we were in. Mm-hmm. But it's just little incidents that were there.
Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss them?
Well, basically, that's about it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Actually, let me.
Some of the stuff, as I explained to you once before, I think some of the stuff I'd rather leave there.
Okay.
As I explained, we have this expression here that what happens on tour stays on tour, which refers to misbehaviour during rugby club functions and rugby club tours. And, you know, I think most New Zealanders will leave most of it behind. You put it in the back of your mind, you don't think about it for years. You know, occasionally something brings something to the fore. Mm-hmm. I don't think personally I suffered too badly in Vietnam. I saw enough action to know really what it was all about. I have been shot at. I have been rocketed. I have been thwarted. Shot at with RPGs, the rocket-propelled grenades, shelled by artillery. So I've seen the whole spectra, so you know, I've basically got enough of it to know what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
But by no stretch of the imagination do I consider that I had to put up with anything like some of what your guys went through. Places like, you know, Kaesan and Hamburg Hill and some of that sort of stuff, you know, I have only the utmost admiration for your soldiers.
Well, when you volunteered to go to Vietnam, I thought you said you had about 3 months left. Is that correct?
Yep.
So, but you stayed for considerably longer in Vietnam.
No, I had to, as I said, I had to sign on to complete a 3-year commitment.
Okay, to go to Vietnam, you had to be on for 3 years.
Yep.
Wow.
Our minimum regular force commitment was 3 years.
Okay. Was this more than you thought you'd be getting into?
Not really, because until the time that I was asked to go,
mm-hmm.
I was just there till Christmas of that year, you know. And at Christmas time, I would pack my bags and go home, and you know, I thought find myself a job and find myself a wife and get married, have some kids, and settle down.
Okay.
Life would just be like it was for everybody else.
Now, just out of curiosity, as a radio operator,
yep.
capable of bringing in artillery strikes, did you ever get the impression, the sensation that the enemy were going to target you first? You'd look for that radio antenna, look for that RTO, take him out so that they can't bring in artillery?
Yep. We're always very, very conscious and very aware of that fact.
Mm-hmm.
None of us wore any badges of rank officers. We were targeted by virtually, I don't know how much the NVA and the Viet Cong would understand what was going on, but we would be picked out quite easily because we had the radio with the little antenna or the big antenna depending on the situation, and that to give us an advantage, we were allowed to use the M16. Officers and radio operators had M16s because of their size and their light weight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's quite a short weapon. Compared to an SLR, it's quite a small weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But it meant that because I was carrying extra radio batteries, that sort of thing. So to offset the weight of those batteries and the equipment, we were given this M16. So that made us a greater target as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you saw a guy with an M16, I think from the Viet Cong point of view, if you saw a guy with an M16... Surely, he must be doing a pretty good sort of a job. He must be fairly important, because the average Australian infantier carried the SLR.
Okay. How did you like the M16 compared to the SLR?
If I had had to use it consistently as an offensive weapon, I would have taken it back to the armory and traded it in for an SLR.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, it's a darling little weapon to carry. It's very easy to look after. It's a good little weapon, but it did not have the hitting power that the SLR did. It was fired that little 5.56 round. which was deflected by twigs and branches and grass and that sort of stuff. The SLR itself was a big, hard-hitting, you know, 5.762 round, NATO round, which went through things. You know, somebody dives in behind a tree, you just dig him out, straight through the tree, out the other side. When I got to the first demonstration they gave us in Waiuru, mm-hmm. with the weapons, they virtually held the SLR out in front of us and said, this machine, this weapon is designed to do one thing, and one thing only, and it does it well. That is to kill people. So they took a 4-gallon tin, which would probably about 5 US gallons, little kerosene tin, put it down on the range at about 25 yards down the range, filled it with water, and fired a round through it. It makes a neat little hole in one side, takes the other side clean out of the tin. The guy said, because the human body has something akin to the consistency of water. So what they then do, they then get a railway sleeper, which is made of Australian hardwood, 12 inches thick, take that down the range, put it on the range, put another tin behind it, and fire a shot again, and it goes straight through the railway sleeper, takes it back out of the tin. It's a demonstration. Basically, what it's used to do is to demonstrate how dangerous the weapon can be.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to, you know, they're trying to frighten you, basically. Say, well, you know, we'll give it to you, but, boy, you be careful with it. But it also gives you the point that you think, well, the only real protection from a well-placed 7.62 round is dirt. Sand, dirt, something that, you know, it'll just soften it.
Mm-hmm.
But a tree, I never, ever considered a tree to be good protection.
Wow. And knowing that the enemy had AK-47s versus 7.62.
7.62, same round, basically mm-hmm. the same round, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the best protection was to get your body as close to the ground as you could,
mm-hmm.
because I think, as we all learned, that the tendency is to fire up rather than, mm-hmm. than along.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember lying in one... remember one contact going on probably 100 yards away from where I was, and I just sat there. I went to ground and then rolled over and sat there because I knew you could hear the stuff going through the trees above you. And you think, well, it's going to have to be a pretty good stray round that gets me here. I think it was a little hump in the ground too. So it's, once again, it's
mm-hmm.
training,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes experience. And, you know, you pass these things on. As somebody new comes in, you pass the information on. You know, mm-hmm. so I reaches out to do something. Don't do that. We patrolled by stealth. You know, if you made a noise, you got the dirty look, the daggers look.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing the M16 was quite good at is if you have a look along the top of it, it's got all these cooling holes. In the plastic cover,
mm-hmm.
there's 10 of it.
I'm sorry, it's what?
There's 10 cooling holes along the top of the M16
mm-hmm.
to allow the heat to escape,
mm-hmm.
and we used to use them as an indicator of how far we had walked, because we used to count the other thing we had to do was count our steps,
mm-hmm.
and the officer would sort of indicate, you know, how far have we, you shrug his shoulders, or how far have we gone, and you would turn around and show him your weapon and point to the, we used to put a little piece of stick into the hole. When you'd gone 100 yards, you'd move the stick into the second hole, into mm-hmm. the third hole. And you would hold it up so that he could count the number of holes to compare with his count, and he would compare it with the other guy, and he would say, right, oh, well, you know, about whatever it was, you know, and sort of average it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that, that's the other advantage the weapon has.
Now, how many men were lost in the 161 while you were there in Vietnam?
Two. 161 battery served there for over 7 years. It had 4 battle casualties and 1 died out of battle.
Wow. That's a pretty good record.
That is an excellent record.
Yes.
There were 37 New Zealanders killed in Vietnam.
Okay.
There were 187 wounded. Mm-hmm. Now, I think some of the wounded were, there was the odd nicks and scratches, and there were probably close to 250 wounded, but there were a lot of, you know, I took some shrapnel and didn't even worry about it because somebody had to dig it out and put a Band-Aid over it and carried on. You know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not indicating that we were tough, but why worry about it? What's a little, you know, nick or a scratch or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't worry about these things. You've got a job to do, you carry on doing it.
Mm-hmm. And how many, while you were in country, do you remember approximately how many artillery missions as a forward observer, RTO, you called in?
Oh, I wouldn't like to think. I couldn't even sit down and work it out.
About, you know, like dozens or hundreds? Or?
Oh, probably in the hundreds.
And when you, after you would call in an artillery strike and...
See, some of them, now let me stop you there.
Okay.
Some of them would be defensive missions. When we stopped and hoochied up for a night,
mm-hmm.
we would quite often fire, we'd look at the map and we would put a few rounds into onto defensive spots that we knew that if we were hit or if somebody tried to walk through us, that this is where they would go or where they would form up or where they would climb out or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we would quite often fire the odd... defensive mission. So in combat missions, in actual combat missions, it would probably come down into the dozens rather than the hundreds.
Okay. Well, when you called in combat missions, would you conduct a walkthrough of the area where the artillery fell to see how many men were killed, or...?
We would leave that to the Australian infantry. We'd do that afterwards.
Okay. Would they give you an idea of the effectiveness of your fire? Do you recall any particular stories?
We would get a few. I think the most we got from any one mission was 11.
Okay.
It was a mission fired from a observation helicopter.
Hmm.
That somebody had spotted a few and just called the stuff in on top of them. And I think that was during the Battle of the Battle of Coral.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most. Generally, we would. We tended to find that they dragged the bodies away. We, you know, you don't know whether they were dragging a body or a wound or what it was. It'd be blood, you know, drag marks and that sort of stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. And how about interaction with Vietnamese civilians? In the area where you were operating, were there many villages or?
Right, I've got it. Hang on, let me just. Let me just get a piece of paper. I've got everything written down. Hang on. Right, and in my time in Vietnam, We had, I've sort of sat down and thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
We had no Vietnamese civilians in our base camp. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In my 12 months there, I was there for just over 12 months. I did not spend one single night away from the military system. In December of 1967, I spent one night in Saigon, which I stayed at Camp Alpha,
mm-hmm.
on my way from Cameron Bay, from the hospital in Cameron Bay, back to Nui Dat. After I'd recovered from malaria, I spent one night in Camp Alpha, basically unsupervised. In late April and early May, right at the beginning of May, I spent a week in Hong Kong on R&R. And then sometime in July, I think it was, or 68, I spent two nights at the Peter Badko Club, which was an R&R centre in Phung Tau.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one trip from Nui Dat to Phung Tau, back to Nui Dat, as a guard on a convoy run to pick up supplies.
Mm.
And that was it.
Well, did you have any interactions with Vietnamese civilians?
No, none at all. The only real interaction that I had with the Vietnamese themselves was to threaten the interpreter that we had with us on one particular occasion.
Mm-hmm.
If he opened his mouth again, I'd put a bullet in it.
What led you to threaten him?
I yelled something out in Vietnamese at the time of a contact, so I stuck the barrel of the M16 up his nose and told him in English first that I would kill him. And I think I translated it into French because he had come from the north and he understood a bit of French. So told him he would be mort if we got shot at again, if we had another contact, and he'd yell, I would kill him. I don't know, maybe it's because I'd had no dealings with him, I have a general distrust of him. That seems to get worse with age, not better.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about with your in-country experiences while you were in Vietnam?
Well, as far as I was concerned, I went there to fight their war. As I say, I feel not ashamed, but I feel that we didn't really... We, and I talk about we, the Australians and New Zealanders, we probably didn't do... we didn't take our share of the punishment that we should have. I don't know whether that's a military decision or whether it's a political decision. I won't go into that. But, you know, when I look at, look at what the likes of the Marines and some of the airborne organisations went through, I think, well, we did. We suffered none of that sort of stuff. You know, we, as I say, there were three major confrontations between the Australians and the Vietnamese. One was the Battle of Long Tan in August of 1966, when the 111 men of B Company 6 Ra walked into about 2,500 Viet Cong, or 2,500 North Vietnamese. They lost 18 in that overnight scrap. Then there was the Tet Offensive of 68, which we had we formed a block just north of Ben Hoa, and then there was Coral in my time. So, you know, we didn't really suffer the likes of Khe Sanh and places like that, where we were under, you know, that intense pressure all the time. So most of our operations were conducted basically by stealth. What have I got here? Okay, the other thing that I might point out is that New Zealand suffered, we did not have any prisoners of war. We didn't lose any of ours to prisoners of war. We have no missing in action. All our guys are accounted for. That's really about all you need to... about all I can tell you.
Well, I'm curious what you think about... in terms of why New Zealand and Australia were not as heavily involved as the Americans, if that's not just a reflection of the American administration, the American fixation on containing communism. And I'm curious if New Zealanders just didn't share, in terms of concern over if the Northern Vietnamese Communist government took over South Vietnam, was that necessarily an issue that New Zealanders or anybody else should be involved in? Or should they...
Well, in reality, we should have been more concerned than the Americans, because they talked about the domino theory that if Vietnam fell, the next would be Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, Malaya. You know, been there, done that. It's closer to us than it is to you, and it has more has a more direct effect on you. I think some of the decision to use New Zealand and Australian forces as they did, remembering that in 1968 New Zealand sent two infantry companies to Australia, sent two infantry companies to Vietnam, that became part of a a battalion of the ANZAC battalion, two New Zealand companies, two Australian companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think they used, they put us into an area that was really, I think there was a fair amount of activity in the area when we went in.
Mm-hmm.
We managed to clean it out, but I think they used us to do the job that we were probably best at.
Mm-hmm.
Patrolling by stealth.
Mm-hmm.
And search and destroy and ambush and that sort of stuff is probably, we were probably better off at that than we were at anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So they used us to our best advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I say, we did have the likes of coral and that sort of stuff where we, mm-hmm. we know what it's like to be have somebody trying to walk straight through the top of you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's you've got to remember as a soldier, as a foot soldier, that there are a lot of decisions made that you will never hear about.
Mm-hmm.
You will never ever understand. We know that. We accept that as being as being part of it.
Mm-hmm.
We just would hope that we are seen to have gone and done our share and mm-hmm. to have done the best that we could
mm-hmm.
with what we were given to do.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Just out of curiosity, when while you were there, were there any special operations forces working in the Phuc Thuy area? In particular, at the time that time period, there was, of course, the Phoenix program, the Phung Hoang program, to neutralize the Viet Cong infrastructure. Were there any operations being conducted in your area that you were aware of?
Not that we know. Not that I know of.
Okay.
We had operating in the area. Our Special Air Service, the Australian, both Australian and New Zealand Special Air Service, but they were a, in Vietnam, they were an intelligence gathering organisation. They went out in four-man patrols
mm-hmm.
To look for activity, and we know they were there
mm-hmm.
because on a couple of occasions we were trying to fire artillery into areas and we were prevented from doing it because we couldn't get a clearance to do it from the hierarchy. And we know that, we would find out later that there's somewhere there was a SAS patrol or a Special Air Service patrol in there. They were not, although they were well trained and well equipped, they were not really combat troops. You can't expect four men to, dig their toes in and stand and fight. But they were there to, find out what was going on. Now, I did keep a little bit of a diary for a short period. I will try and photocopy it
mm-hmm.
and send it to you. And
it covers the period
from mid-April I don't know if it goes into May, but I think I ran out of paper in the end. I was writing it in my little log book, and I kept some information on that. And I think it says in there that the fact that we were dumped into an immobile assault into a LZ
mm-hmm.
That was, we weren't told until afterwards that the SAS had been onto the same LZ, and what happens, this is how much they gather information. The two helicopters that were putting the patrol down hadn't even touched the ground. The guys weren't even out of the helicopters. They took some fire from the surrounding bush. They just came back and the helicopters flew away.
Hmm.
They had found out what they wanted to find out. There was Viet Cong in the area.
Yes.
So they didn't bother to tell us that until after we'd landed. we get in there and the guy said, oh, by the way, SAS came in here, I think it was only 2 days or 3 days before. SAS came in here two or three days ago and got shot at. Oh, that's nice of you to tell us. But have a look at this diary, and I'll try and photocopy it. If I can't, I will try and write it out and send it to you. I'll send it down the fax line to you too.
Okay, that'd be great. Now, how about the SAS calling in artillery strikes?
Generally, no.
Okay.
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
It may well have happened. They generally tended to. They became a nuisance to us on a couple of occasions because we would be moving the battery from one place to another,
mm-hmm.
and they would call to be uplifted, and one of the helicopters or Chinooks that were C-47s or CH-47s would go away and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be left standing there with a, you know, with three guns in one place and three guns in another place trying to transport it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all because there was an SAS patrol wanting to get out. Well, yeah, you know, they're welcome to you know, they're welcome to the helicopters. It becomes a bit of a pain because we, you know, we're trying to get our guns in and dug in and protected before nightfall.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are taking away our method of transport. But it's only happened a couple of times, so...
Now, who would provide you with air support in terms of, you mentioned on a number of occasions being airlifted someplace, so that whether it be you alone going into an area to be a replacement RTO or as a group, who would provide that air support, the helicopter support?
Generally, 9 Squadron Royal Australian Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And the Australians had some... what they're called, Bell 47s,
mm-hmm.
161 recce flight, which were, you know, observation, mm-hmm. light transport, you know, for whatever, personal transport type mm-hmm. aircraft. The first trip I had was in a 47. The rest of the time was all by Iroquois, a couple of times by Chinook, but generally by Iroquois or whatever, UH-1,
mm-hmm.
To wherever. We did use some American... helicopter units on a couple of occasions, but don't ask me where they came from. They were probably based in Bung Tao.
Okay. And how about for close air support? Did you have any close air support assets?
We would use your system, the United States Air Force.
Okay.
Whatever was available at the time.
Mm-hmm. Would you
used?
Uh-huh. Would you be the
sorry, sir?
Would you call in the missions to for American close air support, or would that be handled by someone else?
Had nothing to do with me personally, but it would be the unit commander that would ask for for air support.
Okay.
That would go through another system that would go through from the company to the battalion headquarters, and then from battalion headquarters through the natural system, probably as quickly as they could do it. But me personally, I would just stand there with my mouth open and watch it all going on.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall what aircraft would be employed or were employed while you were there?
We had the A-37s,
mm-hmm.
F-100s, F-4s a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And... did you have a lot of communication with your family at home while you were there?
Not really, all by mail.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it would arrive within a week of being written. Some of it would be a month old before we got it.
And was there much discussion about how the war was being portrayed at home? Was your family discuss that much with you? Or?
No, nothing was ever said.
Yeah. Well, just out of curiosity, a couple of major events that occurred, political events that occurred while you were in Vietnam. One of them was the decision by Johnson. Pardon?
I was going to say the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Okay.
That happened while I was there. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we did not really understand the political implications of it, or exactly. We didn't understand what was going on, so but I remember it happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you were talking about the decision to...
Yeah, Johnson's decision not to run for re-election in 68. Did you guys catch wind of that?
We probably did, but once again, we were, we were politically naive, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see. Oh, yeah, in the area in which you operate, do you know if there were any defoliation missions run? You know, Agent
yep.
Orange?
Yes, quite a few.
And did how effective was that in terms of clearing the foliage and helping your units engage the enemy more effectively?
I think most of the defoliant missions were conducted, they were starting to conduct them about the time we were there, and the effect of them was probably a little bit after I left.
Okay.
We had They tried a jungle clearance program where they just bulldozed great areas of tracts of jungle to provide like areas of flat land where, so that any movement could be seen. I think all it ever did was to help people to move from one place to another a lot quicker because they didn't have to walk through the jungle.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything else you'd like to talk about with regard to your Vietnam service?
Nope, I think we've just about finished then.
Okay. Well, what was it like going home to New Zealand?
I was glad to get home.
Mm-hmm.
No great welcome home parades, no great fuss or anything. My flight home was delayed by a problem in Singapore with a pilot. Remembering, of course, we came home by C-130 mm-hmm. back through the military system. Mm-hmm. My parents picked me up at the Air Force base in Auckland when I arrived home. Went round to my sister's place. She was married to a guy who was in the Navy at the time, and I think we went round and stayed at her house for the night, and then we just drove back home to our family home in Edgecombe. It was about 200 miles from Auckland, and I just went on being a New Zealander. You know, you tuck it in the back of your mind. The local newspaper came and interviewed me for they printed an interview which I never ever really got a copy of, but I think it was just one of those things. You just carry on best you can.
Mm-hmm. Was the Vietnam War at all controversial in New Zealand?
Oh yes, quite controversial, but I think it tended in the smaller communities, like you get a pat on the shoulder, well done boy, and that's about it, you know. From the old guys who'd been World War II and that sort of thing, you know, they knew where you'd been, they give you, a pat on the shoulder. That was all you got. Mm-hmm. That was all you really expected, you know. You didn't want to fuss.
Mm-hmm.
I was posted away from 161 Battery when I came home. I was posted to the New Zealand Army Air Corps, which is where I really wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Although I still had about 15 months of my service to complete when I came home, they couldn't send me back to Vietnam because I didn't have sufficient time to build up, go back, come back home again.
Mm-hmm.
So I got this posting to the Army Aviation Unit at Hobsonville Air Base, which I really enjoyed. I loved aeroplanes and wanted to be around aeroplanes, so that's where I got sent. That's where I saw out my time.
What did you do there?
I was basically a storeman, radio operator, clerk, whatever. The New Zealand Army Air Corps, when it existed, had about probably about 8 officers who were all pilots. One officer who was the administration officer, a sergeant major who was in charge of whatever, I don't know, a store staff sergeant, a clerk, sergeant, and me.
Mm-hmm.
I was the other ranks, that was it.
Okay.
But I still carried on doing, because the Army Air Corps does not have, is not a parent corps, it's not a royal, not the Royal New Zealand Army Air Corps, it's just the New Zealand Army Air Corps, I still had to be part of a parent corps. The artillery was my parent corps, and I went off and did an artillery course, sort of an advanced radio operators course that I hadn't done before I went to Vietnam, so I went and did that because that had the effect of increasing my pay,
mm-hmm.
more qualifications, more pay,
mm-hmm.
and got promoted to Lance Corporal while I was there.
Mm-hmm. What was it like being a Vietnam veteran in New Zealand as time went on? Was there any negative?
Well, that's a question. That's a question I've had asked before, and it's a question I can't answer because I don't know what it was like not being one.
Mm-hmm.
You can understand what I mean by that?
Sure. Well,
it wasn't too bad because those that it's a situation that those that know mm-hmm. and those that have been and those that appreciate what you've done understand what you've been through and what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
Those that got all anti, we had situations where, you know, where our guys were called baby killers and, you know, the normal run-of-the-mill drama.
Mm-hmm.
In New Zealand, we have an organisation called the Return Services Association, the RSA, which I think is something similar to your VFW.
Mm-hmm.
You have a thing over there called VFW?
Yes, sir.
Right. In some RSAs, Vietnam veterans were welcomed. In others, they were not. They're little clubs in the communities.
Mm-hmm.
Some RSAs were, you know, they were pleased to see you. They're, you know, proud of what you've done. I went into the Central Auckland RSA, you know, remembering, of course, I'm only 20, probably 23 at this stage,
mm-hmm.
and sat down at the bar, and I was sitting there with a friend of mine, and we were having a drink, and this guy came up. He would have been a World War II guy, and he came up to me, and he came up to us, and he said, "Where are you guys? What are you guys doing?" He said, "Well, we're, you know, we're Vietnam veterans." Oh, bugger that, he says. "Oh, bugger that. That was one hell of a war." And I said to him, "Well, where were you?" And he said, "I was in the desert," meaning the North African desert. "I was in Italy. I was here." I said, "You know," and it was, you know, one of those funny things. You think, well, this guy's been through hell. He'd been to hell and back, and he's standing there saying, "Oh, bugger that Vietnam." You know, it's just one of those things you don't understand.
Mm.
But generally, you, I think most of us suppressed it for years. Remember, of course, that the anti-war demonstrations got greater in the very late 60s, like 69, then into 70, 71, 72.
Mm-hmm.
It became intense, so you just didn't bother to tell people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It took New Zealand about 30 years to accept what we had, you know, what we had done and what we'd been through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your Mr. Reckner was there to help us too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, you mentioned earlier that you're a member of the
Ex-Vietnam Services.
Mm-hmm.
Services Association. Yep.
Okay. And how long have you been involved with that? And what are their primary activities?
Well, I was one of the group that began the organisation, probably been going, hang on, I'll just ask my wife, she will tell us. How long has the VSA been going, sweet? 20 years, 20-something years? Probably 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the group that started it. After being going for about 2 years, I became the secretary of the organisation. My wife and I organised the first two reunions that we had. We're basically it's a welfare organisation. We try to look after our own members. We are self-funded. We get no funding from government or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we raise our own funds. We have 1,600 members. And we estimate that there are probably just slightly less than 3,000 New Zealand Vietnam veterans still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a pretty good, you know, pretty good membership.
Mm-hmm.
We organise every 2 years we have a reunion, at which time we have our annual general meeting. Now, I don't know whether Mr. Reckner, what's his Christian name?
Jim. James Reckner.
Jim.
Mm-hmm.
James. I don't know whether James went to an AGM or not, but basically when we have a reunion, we get together, we don't sit down and discuss what is going on. We don't. It's not a convention. It is a reunion, and we are there to renew acquaintances, to enjoy each other's company, to, you know,
mm-hmm.
To drink and to tell stories and to see how each other's getting on. As part of the reunion, we hold our annual general meeting, which lasts for about, probably if you're unlucky, it lasts for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you're the president of the Vietnam Veterans of America was at our was at our last London End, he said, I wish that we could conduct our affairs as quickly and as cleanly as that. It's an election. We elect our officers for the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. All the finances are sorted out, you know. Mm-hmm. Presentations are made to those that deserve presentations.
Mm-hmm.
I was secretary of the organization for 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And for my service to the organization, I was granted honorary life membership, something I'm particularly proud of.
Mm-hmm.
Then I moved. That was okay because I was actually living in Auckland at the time. And then I moved away from Auckland, so I resigned from the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else took over, and I came down to live in Waihi.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last, about 6 or 7 years ago, because I now work back in Auckland again, although I live in Waihi, I attended a couple of meetings, and they said to me, well, would you like to come back onto the committee? We'd quite like to have you. So I said, yeah, no problem. So I was nominated and elected to the committee,
mm-hmm.
and I am now back on the committee.
Okay. And have you ever gone back to Vietnam yourself?
No.
Do you ever have any plans to?
I have no real desire to.
Okay.
I have thought about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but let me put it this way: if I was going to spend the amount of money it was going to cost me to go back to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
I would rather go and I would rather come up to the United States
mm-hmm.
and visit with people that speak the same language,
mm-hmm.
that have the same dreams and aspirations and the same problems,
mm-hmm.
and I could go somewhere and enjoy my holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I have now twice been to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I have thoroughly enjoyed it both times.
Okay. And what do you think we should remember most, or what's the most important lesson we should take away from the Vietnam War?
I don't really know. This may be political naivety that I'm using here. I feel sorry in some ways for Central America because of Vietnam. Now, I look at it from the point of view that had Vietnam not happened and the problems of, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago in Central America, Nicaragua and those places like that,
mm-hmm.
I get the feeling that maybe the United States government would have sent its forces in there to sort out the problems. And I wonder if that... Probably what we learned from Vietnam was the fact that politically, if you go and interfere in somebody else's war, they're going to crucify you as a politician.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I...
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And I think, well, maybe if it hadn't been for that sort of thing, if it hadn't been for Vietnam, maybe... I don't know. It's hard to say. That's probably stretching the imagination a little bit too far.
Okay.
I don't know. Go and have a look at the wall. Have you been to the wall?
Yes, sir, I have.
Yeah, you go and have a look at the wall and look at the 58,000 names on that wall. And then go and ask those 58,000 mothers and fathers what it means for them, and I don't know. You won't get, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, I don't know.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, just while I talk about the wall, I went there, probably 1995, I went to the wall, and I was disappointed in what I saw, and what I saw was tourists, I think they were Germans, standing there looking at it, being shown the wall, and I thought, the people are treating this thing as a tourist, as a tourist destination.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It's not there for that sort of thing. I think, I look at it and think, if you go there, if you go to the wall and you don't go away with a lump in your throat and tears in your eyes and a leaden heart, then you shouldn't have gone there in the first place.
Okay. Anything else?
No, that's about it, I think.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I would certainly appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
Okay. Now, you will send me a...
All right. This will end the...